I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hi, I'm Caroline.
And I'm Anna.
And this is Seriously, the pop culture podcast from The New Statesman.
Hello.
Hello.
Welcome back to Seriously for another week.
Lots of you have been getting in touch, re our discussion last week about Alison Bechdel's Fun Home, the graphic novel of her sort of teenage relationship with her father, because we asked you to recommend us other similar things, because also given how much we love Persepolis, we feel like there must be other teen graphic memoirs out there that we could enjoy. And indeed we were right, there are lots.
Yes, you've been warm and generous with your recommendations.
You have indeed. So we had a really lovely email from Iona, who confirmed for us that the kind of older person introducing you to these things is a very important figure. She talks about Gali, a beautiful artist and printmaker who was a neighbour and friend when she was a teenager, helped her get into these things. And she said, as well as patiently answering my questions about page set out and style, she also let me borrow from her extensive graphic novel collection. And it was through this that I read Fun Home and Persepolis. Another one that she lent me, which I can definitely recommend, is Craig Thompson's Blankets. First of all, it's just a beautiful story. And second of all, it's just done with so much warmth and sensitivity that it's almost like being wrapped in a blanket just reading it, which sounds really lovely and makes me really want to read this. It's a really lovely email. Oh, and also, can I just say, the postscript of this email makes me so happy because it just says, P.S. Detectorists, and then there are 6 exclamation marks.
Oh, that's so nice. Thanks, Iona, that's so lovely.
Because we've had a few other sort of tweets and messages and stuff recommending us graphic novel-y type things.
Yeah, I also had a recommendation of Blankets from someone who DM'd me and from a person that I actually know.
Similarly, Eamon left a post on our Tumblr saying exactly the same. The other interesting coming-of-age graphic novel of recent years is Blankets by Craig Thompson. I feel like we're being...
It's canonical, obviously. We need to get on it, definitely.
So yeah, look out for that in a future episode, I think, listeners.
We also had a really lovely email in from Harry Womersley, sorry, Harry, who said, Ari, our discussion of the film Quartet, I thought you might be interested to know that there is at least one retirement home specifically for opera singers. It's called the Casa di Riposo per Musicisti and was set up by Verdi in the late 19th century. A documentary about it called Tosca's Kiss was made about 30 years ago. I also think there are one or two in Austria somewhere. Still, strange place to want to spend your retirement. Thanks, Harry. That's really cute. I had no idea.
I really want to watch that documentary now.
Yeah, me too. It's like, what a specific thing to have, but I think it's really, really interesting. So we also wanted to just do a general public service announcement about spoilers on the podcast.
Yeah, very occasionally people get in touch to ask us, are you spoiling X, Y, or Z?
What is your spoiler policy?
What is your spoiler policy? So, for the avoidance of doubt, this is our spoiler policy. As you know, we like to take all things seriously, and this generally involves talking fairly in depth about something. We will always put the timestamps of the different segments in the show notes. If you are still intending to see something and you don't want to know anything about it, just skip and come back later. That's obviously fine. We will also try at the beginning of each discussion to say how much of something we've watched. So if it's a TV series with lots of episodes, we'll say, we've watched 4 episodes, 5 episodes.
If you're really, really worried about spoilers for something and we say, well, we've watched this many episodes, then you know that there's a risk. But I think if there is a big plot spoiler coming, we will alert you to that
exactly.
before we say it.
But at the same time, it would be a much less fun and probably a bit more asinine podcast if we didn't ever spoil anything. It'd be quite hard to talk about things. It would basically be like us reading out the Radio Times.
Yeah.
Like, a TV program exists. This is the bland sentence about what happens in it, you know?
I used to write those for a newspaper where I'd be like...
Well, there you go. You'd be really good at it.
This week on Dragon's Den, Duncan Bannatyne. Gets a little prickly.
Yeah, exactly.
Be like, I haven't even seen it. Just know it's going to happen.
Those are really euphemistic phrases. So, you know, we could do that, but we won't.
Okay, so with that in mind, the first thing we're going to talk about this week is the film based on the novel Room. Now, I have to say from the off, if you haven't seen the trailer for this film and you've heard nothing about it, I would recommend going in with nothing.
Yes. So the person I went to see it in cinema with did exactly that. And I very carefully, she kept asking me like, oh, what's this film about? Like, I didn't have time to look it up. I was like, nothing in particular.
Yeah.
Because I really wanted her to have that experience.
As long as you know in advance that it is heavy. Like, yes. There are some trigger warnings you should probably have, you know, in your mind for, you know, kidnap and rape. Like, those are the pretty major ones.
Yeah.
But apart from that, you should go in not knowing anything.
So this is the point at which, if you haven't seen the film and intend to, that you need to jump forward to the next section.
Yeah.
So we'll just leave a brief pause for you to do that. Now you've done that.
So you've seen the film?
Yes.
Did you have a look through the book at all?
I've read about half of the book. I didn't manage to finish it.
Okay, cool. I've read the book too. So the general setup, for those of you who are still with us, it's the story of one woman who was kidnapped as a teenager, imprisoned in this room by this guy, and he's obviously sexually abusing her, and she ends up with a child out of that. So where the story starts is we have Ma, as she's mostly known, and Jack, her son, who is 5, and they're in the room. And they're just trying to, like, navigate their normal life in these traumatic, awful, horrific circumstances, basically.
Yeah, so as both a coping mechanism for herself and also to give her son something vaguely resembling normality, she's assembled all these routines and processes for them to fill their time.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of it is very, very domestic. So it's about washing the clothes or washing their hair or, you know, making sure they have meals at, like, meal times and not just whenever they feel like it.
Mm-hmm.
But also, because in the novel it's all told very explicitly from Jack's point of view,
mm-hmm.
but, and they've obviously tried to do that sort of cinematically as well, but you as a sort of adult looking in immediately realize that the reason why they do what he calls phys ed every day is because she's worried about the, like, him not developing properly and mm-hmm. him not growing. So they do, like, jumping jacks and running and all kinds of physical activity. There's a skylight in the roof of the shed. Room is a sort of small shed. They do sunbathing and, like, they lie underneath in the patch of sun, which is obviously an attempt to, like, get him some vitamin D. And so all of these things that she turns them into games for him, but actually they have quite, like, serious underlying reasons.
Yeah, and even their playtime is quite structured. They make lots of things for the room, drawings, they make a snake out of eggshells, these kinds of things, which are obviously in part just to amuse Jack, but also they're quite calculated ways of trying to get him to do, you know, other things that normal children would do, and trying to stop him from just sitting in front of their, like, bad signal TV that they have in the corner all day, because, you know, obviously then he just wouldn't develop properly at all.
The game that I really loved that I don't think was in the film but was in the book is the one that they call Parrot, where she puts the, I think she puts the subtitles on the TV and he has to read them out or something.
Yeah, or he's repeating.
Or he's repeating.
I think he might just be repeating.
He's repeating, but clearly a way for him to, like, learn vocabulary.
And he asks words that he doesn't know.
Because obviously they only have, like, half a dozen books or something that he's read over and over and over again. So to try and, like, keep him educationally developing,
mm-hmm.
that's a good way of doing it.
The way the book is structured is in 4 sections, right? So you have Room at the start, and then you have the second section is called Unlying. We also see this in the film. We get the first half of their time in the room is looking at these routines and so on and their play. And it seems quite light, actually. When I was watching the film, I felt a bit uncomfortable about how light it was feeling.
Mm.
And then you move into a slightly darker half in the room where Ma starts telling Jack there is a world outside, because up to this point she's told him that Room is everything there is, basically, because she's found it very difficult to explain to him that there's this entire world out there that he's restricted from going to and he's missing out on and other children and all that stuff. It was so difficult to try and get a child to even begin to comprehend that she just kind of didn't. Part of that explaining process, it almost makes it hit her all over again, the situation that Jack is in. Once she starts trying to explain it to him, it's almost like she's like, oh my God, this is actually so, so urgent. He's already 5. I need to get him out of here. And she starts basically doing this escape plan with Jack.
Do you remember how Alice wasn't always in Wonderland?
She fell down, 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 deep in a hole.
Right, well, I wasn't always in room. I'm like Alice. Now we've got a chance.
I'm scared.
I know. Truck.
Truck.
Wiggle out.
Wiggle out.
Jump.
Jump.
Run.
Run.
And the burden of the escape plan is all on Jack, really.
Yeah.
Again, big spoilers. They hatch a plan to make Jack look really, really ill. And the theory is then their captor will take him to hospital.
Because the thing we should say that you also get in that first couple of sections is that they're not kept in the room with no contact. Almost every night, their captor comes into the room. Mm. It's got a kind of like a panic room style door with a keypad, mm-hmm. and only he knows the code. You know, he comes in every night. He brings groceries that she makes a list of like what they need. He brings groceries, and then Jack sleeps in the wardrobe while he rapes his mum.
Mm-hmm.
And she's completely fixated and obsessed, as she would be, on the fact that Jack can't be seen by, they call him Old Nick. We never find out his actual name.
Yeah, so the plan is that if Old Nick is convinced enough that he's ill, he'll take him out. That doesn't work. He doesn't want to risk that. So then they pretend that Jack has died from the illness and that he needs to get rid of the body. There are some key differences between book and film at this point that I don't know if you've read that far. In the book, there's a whole subplot that Ma has had another baby that died at birth because Old Nick was so unprepared for a birth. And it came out with the cord wrapped around its neck and instantly died. And he buried it in the garden. And it causes her so much pain because she can tell, you know, that the baby is out there buried just, you know, meters from her. And so when Jack dies, everything she's saying to him is very calculated to make him remember that.
Yeah, you did this wrong the last
time.
Yeah,
exactly. You killed my babies, you know, making it clear that this is your fault again. You've done this twice. And when she says, you know, you have to take him far away, that is really the reason that you believe that he would do that, I think, in the book. Because you're like, okay, he actually saw how traumatic it was for her the first time, you know. There obviously must be part of him that doesn't want her to be completely, you know, unavailable to him because he is trying to come and have this, like, you know, awful style of intimacy with her once a day. But I feel like we should talk about what we actually thought of it.
Yeah, so I found the story as I read it in the novel and then also as I saw it on film completely compelling, kind of uncomfortable and strange and upsetting, but I wanted to read it like a thriller, you know, in the sense because I wanted just to know what happened. I wanted each plot reveal. I got that feeling more intensely from the novel than I did from the film, though. Mm. I think I enjoyed the film, but I didn't, at no point was I completely blown away by it, if that makes sense.
Oh, that's funny, because in the film?
Yeah.
I really was, but I think what really compelled me about the film is also something that I'm kind of dubious about, which is there are so many steps along the way where this film, book, you instinctively want to compare it to a normal childhood and the normal experiences that people have had of childhood. So you get this, like, innocence, and then you get a sudden brutal understanding of the world, and then you get the shock of understanding your surroundings and the kind of horribleness of being separated from your parents gradually, those boundaries coming in more and more. Which is obviously something that I feel very uncomfortable about doing because this is such a specific scenario and it's a real trauma for some people and you don't want to generalise and universalise that pain. You don't want to say, oh yeah, it's a metaphor.
Yes, because what's happened to them is so exceptional and horrible.
Yeah. But at the same time, I also watched this film and I was just sobbing the entire way through. You know, it was so full of anxiety. And what this is, in many ways, is a parental anxiety fantasy.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, imagining the worst things, the worst situations you could be in with your child and playing them out on screen in front of you. And I think, for me, I left the cinema thinking more than in any other film that I've seen, like, oh, I actually feel like I have an understanding of what it would feel like to have a baby and like to love something that much, but also be so scared of what could happen to something that much. I think that's a lot to do with the performances in this film, which are just amazing.
Yes. Oh, the boy who plays Jack is completely incredible. I think it's the best performance, so the best dramatic acting performance I've ever seen from a child actor.
Yeah. So Jacob Tremblay, who was 7 when they found him, and he's now 9, I think, playing a 5-year-old absolutely amazingly. But also Brie Larson, just an incredible performance, and she's Oscar nominated for that performance, quite rightly. I would have loved to see Jacob Tremblay have the same courtesy, because I think these two performances don't work without the strength of the other.
Yes.
And I think to give Brie Larson, if she wins the Oscar, for example, and he's not even nominated, for me that makes no sense, because they're such reciprocal roles. There's so much about the connection and the, you know, the spark between them. The director and the makers of the film and the author of the book have said so many times, you know, this is quite a universal story. And there is so much about sort of, you know, like leaving the womb, like the idea that room is sort of like the womb and all this stuff. But for me, that's kind of feels a little bit uncomfortable to me. This is something that our colleague Barbara has been saying as well. But I don't know where you can draw that line in art and say, actually, this is just a universal story out of specifics, because that's what all art is to an extent.
Yeah, you don't really want to say that this is in any way that motherhood is like being trapped in a tiny room by a crazy person. I don't know. You're right. That's a really uncomfortable kind of parallel to draw. But it is pushing you in that direction all the time, isn't it?
Yeah, and it is also, as you said at the beginning, a story about trying to find normality in these situations. Parents essentially nagging their children into doing things properly.
One bit that I found completely devastating was when they're still in room. We should say as well that another way in which the room is kind of, the tension in there is heightened, is that Jack and Ma refer to room as room, like with a capital R, not the room.
Everything's personified.
Everything in it is personified. And Jack kind of says, good morning rug, good morning bed, good morning wardrobe. Like he thinks of everything as being sort of alive and his companion in some way. But so there's a day, I can't remember where it happens, but basically Jack says Ma is gone with a capital G. Mm. And obviously she's just too depressed to move. Like she just lies in the bed all day and Jack has to take care of himself. And he's quite kind of, he's not okay with that, but like the routineness of it just tears at your heart.
Yeah.
Because like, and that I think is, you know, if you were a child who grew up with a parent who had a mental illness or mental health problems or anything, then yeah, there would have been days when they were just gone and you had to fend for yourself. Like that for me was a bit more universal and kind of...
Definitely. Yeah. And I think for me as well, that was the point where I was, because she does seem so normal and like she's coping so unbelievably in that first bit, and also the first bit of when they're out of the room, that you need to see her experiencing this deep depression in order to be like, okay, yes, this is... That for me felt more respectful to what you'd actually be like if you had gone through something like that. And I think one of the things it does so well is just, because obviously this is an experience that's very claustrophobic in a lot of ways, but not really for Jack, because he likes it in a weird way.
And
he likes being, because he wants that closeness with his mum and he's never known any different. And so I think one of the things that really, really tore at my heart was just all of those little portraits of parental child intimacy. Even like, you know, them cuddling in the bed. So he has to sleep in the wardrobe in case old Nick comes, but then she pulls him out of the wardrobe and pulls him into her bed and they kind of like cuddle. And that really, really got me.
Yeah,
and like little moments like that when they're in the bath or...
Yeah, because he goes to sleep in the wardrobe and then wakes up in the bed.
Yeah, every day. And just, but, you know, all those little things. And it's the same when they came out of the room when, you know, there are just sometimes these little, mostly physical moments where you're just like, oh my gosh, they're, you know, that is just, the level of intimacy there is so, so close. And a lot of Ma's kind of difficulty coming out of the room is knowing that she has to try and, like, encourage him to be without her. And that, I think, it did so well. Yeah, so I liked it, I think, overall.
Yeah, I did as well. I was not quite so kind of punched in the gut as I was expecting to be, because the novel did affect me that way.
Mm.
I'm not sure.
I found it weirdly, I was more like that in the film. Mm. I was like, with the escape sequence and them being reunited afterwards, so stressful. Worst, like, most, even though I sort of knew that he was going to make it out because I'd seen the trailer, and the trailer's full of shots of them outside of the room.
Yeah.
I was just like, oh my gosh, I can't cope with this. And I think the director and the author and stuff have said that they kind of deliberately did that because they knew that it would be so much if you don't know what's on the other side. But yeah, I really hope Brie Larson to win the Oscar for that performance.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Yeah.
Now we're going to talk about the Netflix Marvel series, Jessica Jones, which is part of the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
I don't know if it's the Cinematic Universe.
What do you call it?
I don't know. I've been told off about this before, that the Cinematic Universe is apparently something different to the TV stuff, but whatever.
Okay, fine. It's part of the Marvel world, yep. That thing. And it's about Jessica Jones, who is basically a PI, who also has these sort of abilities.
Yeah, she's really strong.
Yeah, she's really strong. We get the sense that she's not the only one with these abilities. She lives in New York, and she's basically trying to get by, it seems.
Yeah.
She's got a few issues. She's seems to be suffering from PTSD. You realise that pretty early on, because she's having these very strange sort of flashbacks, and she'll be on the tube and stuff, and like images will come into her mind, or sat on a fire escape and these images start flashing into her mind. So it seems like she's having some sort of trauma related flashbacks, and she's also drinking a lot.
She's
fully committed to the whiskey in the paper bag when she walks down the street, that going for the real, like, yep, yeah, I'm just gonna wear this alcoholic badge wherever I go.
A big part of the job is looking for the worst in people. Turns out I excel at that.
You a PI?
I'm just trying to make a living. You know, booze costs money. Usually.
Jessica Jones. I saw you.
What do you want to know?
Can you punch through a wall? Stop a moving car.
A slow moving car.
We get introduced to her by seeing her get given a case.
Yeah, so it kind of goes on from there, really. I mean, I didn't really like Jessica to start with. I found her kind of abrasive and
quite abrasive.
Abrupt and yeah. So on. But you very quickly realise that these are not exactly character traits, but more responses to things that have happened to her. Like, she has become like that as a kind of defense mechanism. Again, dive out now if you don't want to be spoiled. The reason she's like this is because of this kind of shadowy figure of someone else who has extraordinary abilities, but this person, rather than having extraordinary strength, has the ability to control the people around him.
Yeah, it's like an extreme, not even charisma, but, you know, it's kind of like manipulation and charisma on steroids. He just says stuff like, you'd like to give me some dinner? And people are like, oh my God, yeah, I'd love to.
Yeah, or like, I like your jacket, give it to me.
Yeah.
And you're just overwhelmed with desire to
give it to him.
To give it to him. Mm-hmm. And of course, he's using his powers for evil, not for good. And we learn that Jessica has escaped from his control, that mm-hmm. she was formerly controlled by him and somehow managed to get away from him. And now, although she is just trying to kind of make ends meet by working as a private investigator, you know, taking pictures for people to use in their divorce proceedings and stuff like that, she is also on the lookout for this man, Kilgrave, his name is, coming back to get her, or signs that he's in some way influencing her life again.
Well, we open the series and she's pretty certain that he's dead.
Yes.
He's been ruled dead. We saw a death certificate, but he's still in her mind stalking her because she's still struggling to overcome this trauma of Kilgrave, played by David Tennant very well. Mm. And I think we've talked about this before, but this is largely a kind of metaphor. You're encouraged to draw parallels between what he's done to her and domestic abuse, basically, aren't you?
Very much so, yeah. I mean, so I've watched, I think, 5 episodes.
I've watched 3.
You've watched 3. So, but I think generally, quite early on, the atmosphere that we get from her flashbacks of her, if you can call it a relationship with him, is that it had all of the kind of coercive, controlling aspects of domestic abuse.
Yeah. So he buys her gifts, takes her out to nice restaurants, does all of that, and also makes her do things that she doesn't want to do because he says that she has to. And, you know, you don't even need the supernatural element there for that to be a traumatic situation.
Yeah, and a lot of the things he seems to want to make her do are kind of to fulfill this role. So he wants to go to a specific restaurant, he wants her to wear specific lingerie, like
it's you know, he wants her to smile while she's at it.
It's all about her playing this role that he's concocted in his head, and in order to do so he has to completely eliminate her free will.
Yeah. So I want to go quite like plot detail heavy on the first episode of this, spoilers and all. And what happens is she gets presented with a case, and it's a sort of missing young person, but she's not actually missing because she's calling her parents once a week. But their suspicion is that she's in some kind of cult or something. She's dropped out of university. She was a very gifted athlete and she stopped running. So they're just like, please, can you help us? They were referred to her by, you assume, a policeman, someone at the police station. And as the episode goes on, Jessica realizes that this girl is under the same control that she was from the same man. He's doing all the same things, taking her to the same restaurants, making her wear the same clothes. She can see all her purchases on this girl's credit cards and it's all the same. And essentially she rescues her and she manages to take her away from the hotel room that Kilgrave has left her in, despite her like screaming and kicking and saying, I can't leave. But Jessica, with her strength, manages to...
That's one of the most horrible moments, I think, is she finds Hope, her name is the girl, she finds her in the hotel room and she's lying motionless in the bed. And for a second you're like, oh my God, she's dead.
Yeah.
And then Jessica's like, he told you not to move, didn't he?
Yeah. And she says she wet the bed because she wouldn't move and she's been there for like 6 hours. Which is something you can imagine happening in a terrible relationship like that, in an abusive relationship. And she manages to rescue her, takes her back to her office to meet her parents, and then sends them off in the lift, and she's going to meet them downstairs. And there's just this awful moment. I was, you know, I found this program scary as it was. And then in the final moments of this episode, she's in the lift with her parents. She's gone all glassy-eyed, like she's not in control of her behaviour anymore. And you just see her get a gun out of her bag, shoot both of her parents. And then she kind of comes out of it and she's just like screaming at what she's done. And it's like so horrible and it's so unexpected and shocking. And that kind of sets you up for the kind of stuff that's to come in the series, basically, doesn't it? Because Jessica is just trying to stop people from doing terrible things under the influence of this man. And obviously it's almost impossible to stop people.
And it sort of becomes clear as well that not only is he not dead, but also that he's trying to toy with her.
Mm-hmm.
That so... The reason he sort of took up with Hope and then sent Hope to her is to mess with her.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's all of his actions are related to Jessica in some way.
And I haven't watched far enough to know, but the feeling that I get is because she's perhaps the only one who's managed to break out of his control.
Yes,
and
he's
kind of furious about that, and he wants to make her pay for that.
Well, I think what you're kind of led to believe is that if you had those kind of controlling abilities, you would very quickly believe that they were absolute and unbreakable. And if someone's been proved you wrong about that, you'd be really angry.
Yeah. So it's really good. And what I like about it, actually, is what they've clearly tried, I think, in my opinion, to do, which is to really minimise the superpower aspect of it in favour of a programme that looks more deeply at, like, relationships. It's more film noir-y than it
very
is
much so,
superhero-y,
yeah.
Because she is these, you know, when we're saying at the beginning, she's got all these traits like abrasiveness and alcoholism, and she's very much in the vein of that kind of like misanthropic PI from the, you know, like 1930s, 40s, whatever, film noir movies. And for me, the dialogue in this is kind of, can be weak. It's kind of cliched. It's kind of full of you can't be near me, which is, you know, also a very superhero-y trope. Mm. You know, I'm dangerous. It's better if I distance all people from me so that they don't become targets. But what it does do is it puts those very classic masculine lines in the mouth of a woman, no less, you know, a domestic violence survivor. And I think that is something to be said for that. There is something new there, even if you're like, well, I've heard that line before.
Yeah, definitely. And I like as well that there's no... So I think it's in the first episode, isn't it, when she's doing a kind of routine, so, you know, serving some papers on, mm-hmm. on someone mm-hmm. for on behalf of a lawyer. And she ends up, like, picking up his car with one hand mm-hmm. in order to get him to listen to her. But that's kind of... I think as much as I've watched, that's... I can probably count on one hand the time that she displays excessive strength mm-hmm. to get her way. She's not exactly embarrassed about her abilities, but she's just uncurious about them. Mm-hmm. She doesn't want to, you know, there are no, like, random shots of her, like, flying around New York or anything to give you that kind of cinematic, woo, I'm Spider-Man moment or something. It's just not important.
And perhaps it's because she's seen what can happen if you take them too seriously. But I definitely like that, because I'm not someone who's overly into the sort of capes and you know, underwear on the outside style of superhero stuff.
I just thought of, have you seen The Incredibles?
Yeah.
You know, the fashion designer character from that, when she's like, no capes!
Edgar Mould, or whatever. So for me, this is hitting all the right notes. I really like it. I think that you have to go in with an allowance. There's going to be a bit of, you're quite the firecracker, Jessica Jones.
Yeah,
there's all of that. But it's worth it, in my opinion, because it is interesting. The plot so far is still surprising me. I like it tonally. I like it visually. I think it's good.
I think it has... And this is unsurprising because they kind of come out of the same studio. It has things in common with Agent Carter, which we talked about.
I like this more than Agent Carter.
I kind of like, I'm not sure yet, but I think possibly I will, yeah.
I didn't carry on with that Agent Carter, even though I liked the main character. But I think because I felt more overwhelmed by all the extra info that was going on, like, there was a lot of detail and I'm not that acquainted with the universe.
Agent Carter's more closely woven in with the whole Captain America storyline, whereas this is, I think, following on from Daredevil.
Right.
But you just don't need to have seen Daredevil for it to make any sense.
Not at all.
Very, in the next couple of episodes, they very occasionally refer to, like, a major cataclysmic event, which I think is some kind of alien invasion.
Yeah, they talked about that in the first episode.
But
the Green Men.
This is just not, you know, all you need to know is what they say in the dialogue, which is there was this alien invasion and the people like Jessica saved the city. That's it.
Yeah.
Like, you don't need to have seen the invasion. And that I really appreciate, because I think the Marvel films and TV series are at their best when they translate for people who haven't read the comic books or whatever. You know, when they're just good standalone pieces of art.
Definitely. And I'm far more into crime than I am, like, on TV than I am into sort of superhero stuff. So for me, this works because it's like, oh, it's like a fun crime thing so far.
Yes, and she does, this is probably a really stupid comparison, but she does have periodic realizations like Inspector Morse, you know, like, like Inspector Morse, she will just, like, sit in her room for ages thinking about something and then be like, aha.
Yeah.
And I'm very much more into, it's part of the reason why I love the kind of golden age 40s and 50s detective novels so much, is because most of the action happens in the hero's head.
Yeah. And she is good as well. Like, she's really, really good at her job, and it's not part of her superpower. So, she more impressive than anything to do with her super strength is the fact that she can just call people up and be like, and she's really good at lying. She's really good at getting people to give her stuff that she wants. And you're just like, yeah, she's just a really, really capable, persuasive woman. And I like to see that.
Yes, definitely. And it's also worth mentioning that she's not the only capable woman character.
There's loads.
There's loads. Like, her best friend Trish is another one. The lawyer at the firm that she sort of freelances for is another one. It's one of those programs where you immediately become blissfully unaware of the fact that you are mostly watching women on screen, which is such a rare feeling, because most of the time you're watching all men and, like, there's the one lady standing in the corner.
And actually, now you mention it, like, it's pretty diverse. They're not all white and they're not all straight.
Yeah.
At all, in any way. So that is hitting those buttons as
well.
But
what's I think so good about that is that you didn't notice that.
No, I didn't really.
So it's not being like, well, hey, let us wave our diversity agenda in your face. It's like, this is just people.
Yeah, exactly. Living in New York, so.
So of course.
It would be weird.
It would be weird if there wasn't, like, a major black character, etc. Yeah.
Thank you.
So last week, I gave Caroline the Technicolor delights of Sheep in the Big City, the Cartoon Network kids cartoon starring a sheep who escapes to the big city. Caroline, what did you make of Sheep in the Big City?
I love Sheep in the Big City.
Did you?
I spent quite a lot of time on eBay trying to find if there were DVDs.
I have a DVD.
Can I borrow it?
Yeah, I don't know if I've got it in my London flat. I found one in a pound shop once, and I was just like, you know, we were talking about, did I dream this? I saw the DVD and I was like, it wasn't a dream. It just was like buying. Absolutely buying. I don't think I've ever even watched the DVD.
I want to watch more. So I've only seen the first episode because that's all I could find on a easy Google on the internet. Mm-hmm. But no, I mean, for context for listeners, I really like things that involve sheep anyway. I spent quite a lot of last year because there was this big book out that was about a shepherd in the Lake District. So I like interviewed him and I wrote multiple pieces about it. And then I read a whole load of other books about shepherds. And then I wrote more pieces about it. So yeah, I'm already quite invested in things that
sheep do.
And it also reminded me really quite strongly of the Shaun the Sheep film. Have you seen the Shaun the Sheep film?
Yeah, I haven't seen it, but I obviously know who Shaun the Sheep is from his many adventures in Wallace and Gromit, A Close Shave.
Yes, so Shaun the Sheep got his own spin-off film last year in which it's kind of the roles are reversed as they are in Sheep in the Big City, but what happens is the sheep have decided they've been working far too hard, you know, grazing, and that they deserve a day off where they get to hang out in the farmhouse and watch TV.
Yeah.
So they sort of trick the farmer into falling asleep in this caravan on the farm, and then they're like living it up in the farmhouse having a lovely time. But then disaster strikes in that one of the chocks comes out from under the caravan wheels, and the caravan with the sleeping farmer goes hurtling all the way down the hill into the city.
Yeah, it sounds like a similar setup.
Basically, so then the sheep all have to go to the city in order to get their farmer back. So it's kind of roles are reversed.
Yeah, because the farmer in Sheep in the Big City is looking for his lost sheep.
But so I just felt like, there's a strong canon here of like,
sheep gone missing
sheep
stories.
Sheep gone missing in urban areas.
Yeah. Oh my God, and also obviously that is the inversion of Babe 2, Pig in the City.
Pig in the City, yes, exactly. So I think there's definitely a whole kind of, One could get quite poncy about the intrusion of the pastoral into the urban.
Oh my God, that is actually so funny, and we should. It is quite weird though, right?
It is quite weird, because obviously unlike those things that we've just mentioned, Babe and Shaun the Sheep, in this, it's a cartoon, it's not stop motion or live action pigs. And also there's the, what are they called? The like general guy.
General public. And private specific.
Yes, the military people who are also searching for the sheep because of ray gun reasons.
They have a sheep-powered ray gun, and it's literally, have you seen the ray gun in the first episode? It's just like a big machine with a sheep hole
in
it.
Yes, a sheep, sheep space. Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's a whole kind of dimension of threat that you don't get in those other things.
Yeah, well, I don't actually remember that much plot-wise about Sheep in the Big City. I seem to remember it tonally a lot more. Like, it's got this weird, like, fairly sarcastic almost tone, even though it is quite surface level wacky and colourful.
And it reminded me, it's not nearly as much as something like Adventure Time or Archer, which are cartoons that are clearly aimed at grown-ups. Mm. But I did feel like there was an element of that.
I do think it's a bit of a precursor to things like Adventure Time, because it's got the same sort of colourfulness and weirdness that you'd expect from a children's cartoon, but it's got a sort of dryness that you would expect from something aimed at adults.
I can imagine if I'd watched it as a child would have just gone right over my head.
Yeah, and I think I remember what I loved about it. I don't know if they had, did they have any ad breaks in the first episode that you watched? They do like fake ad breaks.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, and I loved those. And those are clearly taking the mick out of adverts, but in a way that feels a bit more adult. It feels a bit more satirical almost. Satirical is not quite the right word, but you know what I mean.
Because the fake ad break is a big part of Saturday Night Live and stuff like that, the commercial parody. So yeah, which is obviously aimed at grown-ups.
Yeah, and they say, do you think, I remember they had one that was just like a girl stroking the hair of her dolly, saying it over and over again, like, this is my dolly. And it's like kind of creepy and weird. And you're like, whoa, that was random. Why? Yeah, so there's an element of it perhaps influencing later Adult Swim style stuff.
Yeah, certainly. And as I say, like, I just found it really delightful. And given that, as we've said, the other two things that we've talked about this week, Room and Jessica Jones, are both
quite heavy.
Quite heavy. Having Sheep in the City to look forward to was nice.
Yeah. So what are we doing for me next time?
I am going to recommend you Miss Fisher's Murder Mysteries.
Oh, this is the thing that we were recommended recently.
We have been recommended by, I think, a few listeners.
Yeah. Is it Australian?
It is Australian. I also put a piece about it in my newsletter a while ago, and it okay. I think it's probably generated the most inbox traffic that anything I've ever put in there. So many people emailed me being like, oh my god, I love that program, thank
you
so much.
How funny.
So the story of it is that it's made by the Australian Broadcasting Company, I think the kind of BBC equivalent there.
Mm-hmm.
But when it got on Netflix, it went massive in America.
Okay.
And now it's become this.
So that's fairly recently, though.
Yeah, so it's become this kind of cult hit in the US and I think to an extent in the UK, even though we would never normally really get Australian things as exports.
So will it be on my UK Netflix?
Yeah, it's on UK Netflix.
Okay, great.
So other listeners who want to kind of catch up and watch along for next week, yeah, if you've got a Netflix subscription, it'll be there.
Great.
It's set in the 20s. It's a kind of detective, as the title suggests. Miss Fisher is a sort of private detective,
which listeners will remember from 5 minutes ago I like.
Yeah, and so she sort of solves mysteries for people.
Is she a Miss Marple-y figure?
No, she's a lot younger than that.
Okay.
And she's also quite progressive in her views and lifestyle and stuff. There's a kind of constant theme which I think is really interesting, and it's definitely interesting for a kind of UK US perspective. Well, she's working in the early 1920s. Obviously the First World War is very, very recent.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a recurring theme that quite a lot of the time the crimes end up being in some way related to like someone's PTSD or some kind
right.
of regimental argument or something like that.
So you can't even be like, boo, bad guys.
No, it's more complicated than that a lot of the time. And like the policeman that she works with on a semi-regular basis also has his own stuff related to that. And I feel like we don't often get the kind of Australian perspective on what were supposedly world wars.
Yeah,
so
no,
that's,
not at all.
I find that really interesting as well.
Okay, great.
Big thing to watch out for, the clothes. The clothes
okay.
are amazing.
Okay, I'll get my notepad out.
I want to know your top three outfits Miss Fisher
okay,
wears
sure.
next week. Thanks for listening to Seriously, the pop culture podcast from The New Statesman.
You can find us on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes and Tumblr. All the links are at newstatesman.com/srsly.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.